Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to get started, and you can certainly continue enjoying your lunch while we go forward. My name is Jennifer Cates, and I'm with the Kaiser Family Foundation, and want to thank everyone for being here, and thanks CSIS, who's sponsoring this event, for asking me to moderate. It's always fun to moderate something that I think will be really stimulating and cause us to think. Sometimes we're moderating things that are stuff we've all heard before. So I think today will be really interesting for all of us, for me. Hopefully people here have had a chance to read the book that we're going to hear about. And there are books available for sale right out there. So please, if you don't have one, consider getting one. But without going on and on about that, we're very excited that Elizabeth Pisani is here with us. Many of you have read her book or have read about her. She has been speaking and writing about some really important issues on the global AIDS crisis and how to think about it for a few years now. And I actually learned more about the history of your involvement with UNAIDS when I read the book, and it was very interesting. And I think it's rare that we have an opportunity to hear from someone who's both been a reporter, been an activist, and an epidemiologist, all of those things together. Usually you get one or the other, but the unique package of putting them together, I think, is why the book itself is so compelling and caused me to think about just how we make policy, how we make decisions around HIV and other issues. And I have a lot of questions, but I'm just moderating. So what the format's going to be is that Elizabeth's going to present and talk about her experience in the book. And Janet Fleischman, who is also does work with CSIS on gender issues, will respond and ask some questions as well. But we really want to have a discussion with everyone here. So we'll just make it a back and forth at that point. And I think you'll enjoy hearing from Elizabeth. So take it away.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks all for being here on what I'm sure is a busy day for everyone ahead of the elections and, of course, ahead of getting into your pumpkin costumes this evening. I promised that I would dress up for the occasion, and by my standards, I have. Now, I start every presentation I've learned to with two slides just to put everyone on the same page, because we're endlessly taught about the global pandemic and everything we read is about the global pandemic. There is no global AIDS pandemic. There are two separate HIV epidemics, and one of them is in sub-Saharan Africa, largely in East and Southern Africa. There are small outposts of this epidemic in a few other places, Haiti, perhaps parts of Papua. But essentially, HIV in this first epidemic is concentrated in countries that cover 10% of the world's population. They also cover 2/3 of the HIV epidemic and 3/4 of the deaths from AIDS at the moment because of the unequal access to medicine, a gap that's now closing fairly rapidly. So 10% of the world's population, 66% of HIV, and about 40 million infections so far. That's 40 million prevention failures. The rest of the world, the other 20 million, is this. These are just random photos taken off my hard drive. They're all but one of them are friends of mine. All but one of them have a penis. Several of them I've been in love with. A couple of them I've slept with. One of them I was even married to. And every single one of these people falls into one of the groups that comprise most of the rest of the epidemic. That is, they are males, females, and transgenders who sell sex. They are drug users, they are regular clients of sex workers, and they are gay men who hang out on the scene and change partners regularly. And this is the HIV epidemic in most of the world. Now, that's a difficult thing to say. It's very hard to say that HIV is not a development problem, it's not a poverty problem, it's not a problem of gender or migration or anything else, it's a virus. Principally, it's a virus that is transmitted in a very limited number of ways. It spreads between people who share needles when they're injecting drugs and people who have unprotected sex with a number of partners, particularly when that number of partners is concentrated within a relatively short time span because of the way the virology of HIV works. So it's drug injectors, it's people who sell and buy sex, it's gay men, and increasingly that's an emerging epidemic in parts of Latin America, Asia, and now we're seeing it in Africa also. Men in jail all over the world, including in this country, our prisons are essentially HIV factories, and East and Southern Africans. That's the HIV epidemic in the world. Now, that's a very, very difficult thing to say in a political context. So, it's difficult to say because no one actually gives a damn about most of those populations. So if you say we really need a lot of money to deal with this problem, and the problem is people who earn you no votes at all, we don't get that money. When I started in this business with UNAIDS in 1995, 96, we had $250 million to deal with HIV worldwide. $250 million for all HIV prevention and care efforts in the developing world. Obviously, it wasn't enough. Obviously, we needed a lot more. But if we went to Congress or to the major institutions or to the public and said, could you give us some money, please, because we need to give clean needles to junkies, we weren't going to get very far. So what did we do? We made it about something else. We made it about particularly about innocent women and children. We made it to a certain extent about money. If you invest money in prevention now, you'll save money in treatment later. That didn't work really well. And the reason that it didn't work was because politicians essentially think, particularly in democracies, think in the short term. So they think as far as the next election. So if you say, do something really unpopular now because it'll save you money later on, they're going to go, yeah, but if I do something unpopular now, I won't be here later on because I'll be voted out of office. So that kind of backfired. So we need to make it about people who are not the wicked groups that are actually most affected by HIV in most of the world. We needed to make it about innocent people. Now, we could do that with some plausibility in as much as no one is in a hermetically sealed risk group. People are part of a larger fabric. So when we make a distinction between high-risk groups and the general population, we ignore the fact that high-risk groups are part of the general population and also have sex partners who don't necessarily fall into their groups. So we said, okay, if we don't do something for these high-risk groups now, we're going to have a bigger problem in the general population. We also then did a slight sleight of hand and implied that if we let it get as far as the sex partners of the high-risk groups, it will then somehow assume a life of its own and start spreading through the general population. We knew as early as 1995 that that was not the case. That was not going to be the case in any continent outside of sub-Saharan Africa. But we did it, and it worked. So it became a development problem. The second point here is a direct quote from actually a rather good World Bank document called Confronting AIDS. But poverty and gender inequality spread AIDS. It's like, oh, shit, I thought it was sex that spread AIDS. But no, poverty and gender inequality, go figure. HIV is a threat to global security. I think many people in this room are familiar with that claim and familiar with putting that in the headlines. It worked from the point of view of cash as well. So when I started, we were hanging out around here, $250 million a year, and we've seen an extraordinary ramping up to about $10 billion a year. And this year, if the PEPFAR commitments are made good on, it'll be closer to $15 billion. So that's a great thing. But because of the sleight of hand that we used in getting this money, we made it almost impossible to use the money effectively. So, we've got all this extra money. Are we getting better prevention value for it? So, back here in the mid-90s, we were spending about $70. This is just prevention money. I've taken the care money out of this because, of course, treatment was a big part of that ramp-up. So we were spending about $70 per prevention failure. Deaths are rising. We kind of are doing slightly better at prevention, perhaps, but, oh, my goodness, we've still got 2.5 million people will be infected this year by something that is perfectly preventable, And we're doing it at a cost of nearly $3,000 per prevention failure. That's what we're spending to fail to prevent HIV in our prevention programs. I'm a great fan of Gary Larson, and I love this cartoon because it really reminds me of what was going on in our world, I think. We were saying we need to focus prevention on high-risk groups because if we don't, we're later on going to have a bigger problem in innocent women and children. And what the politicians heard was, blah, 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 innocent women and children. And so the money went to programs that were for the general population, that were for pregnant women, that were for... But the money that was invested in programs for drug injectors in the sex trade and for gay men didn't increase very much. Now, why is that? Why did we allow that to happen? Well, it's partly because there are so many vested interests in this now very, very large industry. So in the AIDS oligarchy, the AIDS mafia, of which I am a card-carrying member, no one was going to say, look, we really need to focus on these groups because if we don't, you know, we won't be doing anything effective in prevention because the money would evaporate very quickly. I'm always amused by, well, not amused, but, you know, you open your Sunday Times and whatever, and the flyers fall out of, you know, little brown children with big eyes, and for just $3 a day, you can keep this child in school for, you know, for life, and you think, oh, isn't that fantastic? I've never seen one that's a grainy shot of a junkie down a back street that says, for just 3 cents a day, you can keep this junkie in clean needles for life. We have a problem with that sort of thing. We know that if we make those claims, we're going to lose money. Politicians obviously are going to lose votes if they make a strong case for prevention in those groups. Religious groups are not demanding focused prevention because it would be demanding services that compromise the morality that they espouse, help for wicked people to stay wicked. And AIDS activists, I think this is the interesting one. Why didn't the AIDS activist community do better at really trying to focus prevention where the greatest risk of exposure to HIV was? It's really because of the history of the epidemic and the history of its being so intimately associated with deeply stigmatized groups in this country. And it was, so you had this sort of concurrence of HIV with stigmatized behaviors, which increased the stigma attached to those behaviors. So when, for largely monetary purposes, we started making the case that HIV is everyone's problem, the AIDS activists bought into that because it, to a certain extent, lessened the stigma that was associated with HIV as a problem of gay men, HIV as a problem of sex workers, HIV as a problem of drug injection. So I wanted to talk about some of the sacred cows that we've actually essentially built up and started herding around as a result of the history of the epidemic. And there are several ranches which are now fattening up these cows. The activist ranch, it's very much still now... our activist approach is still based on a rights-based approach. And you actually can't argue with that, of course, except that the balance between individual rights and the rights of the infected and the rights of the uninfected are now seriously out of whack. But there's been a very strong anti-testing bias in activist groups for obvious historical reasons. When we started out in this epidemic, if you got an HIV test and you were tested positive, you would lose your health insurance, you would lose your job, you would lose a lot of your friends, you may lose the love of your family, and quite shortly after that, you were going to lose your life, and in rather an unpleasant way. So what's the point of getting tested? We couldn't do anything for people who are tested. So there was a very strong anti-testing bias, and that persists even though the situation has changed quite dramatically. Pro-treatment bias, obviously, because most of the activist groups were put together by people who were infected with HIV, and therefore their first interest is to try and increase access to treatment very sensibly. But that does mean that there's been less attention on the activist side to prevention. And then the whole belief that NGO responses and small community-based responses are necessarily the most effective way to go. Why did that happen? Because in this country, the government was in gross dereliction of duty in taking any real action on HIV when it first emerged among gay men. It was just like, oh, ick. Ronald Reagan didn't actually speak the word AIDS for 4 years after it was a well-established infection in the gay community. Because of that, the gay community had to organize itself, and it organized itself extremely effectively and put together some very, very good HIV prevention campaigns in the community. But that's led to a belief that community-led responses are always best and NGO-led responses are always best. Junkies are not always a community. They turn one another into the police. They're competing for access to drugs. They're competing to keep out of the police net. Sex workers, the same thing. They're in direct competition for clients. So it's not safe to assume that a sex worker wants to spend her time that she could be with a client earning money, doing voluntary work, telling other sex workers how to stay safe. On the religious rant, it's so easy to poke fun at the religious sacred cows that it's almost not worth doing, except that in this country and for the period of the very generous PEPFAR funding, they have called the shots, and so this is important. So all of these ideas that, you know, providing condoms promotes sex, providing needles promote ejection, as a 40-something-year-old single white woman living in Southeast Asia, I've had occasion to engage in some participatory research about some of these precepts, and I always carry condoms. And I'm here to tell you that that doesn't make it any easier to get laid. It's not that easy. We have never, ever had an example of someone who's started shooting up drugs just because clean needles were available. Oh, look, clean needles, great. I'll try shooting up smack. It doesn't work like that, and we know it. But these are still beliefs that underlie a lot of the reluctance to use money in the way we need to use it. The whole women and children are innocent victims thing is an important force behind the extraordinary generosity that has come really because of the evangelical and Christian right movement in this country. It was that need to be compassionate to the victims of HIV, which is really behind the extraordinary hallucinatory amounts of cash which are available thanks to you, the generous us, we, the generous American taxpayer. But we really actually haven't taken the concept of compassion one step further back to prevention. It's fine to be compassionate to someone once they're infected, but we're not compassionate enough to give them a clean needle so that they don't become infected in the first place. So that really is promoting a pro-treatment bias. And, of course, the whole thing about the sex trade, the equation that is coming particularly out of the religious right in this country, the fundamentalist Christians in this country, the equation of prostitution with trafficking, as if it's one and the same thing, is making it very, very difficult to work constructively with sex worker groups around the world. The AIDS industry, well, HIV is everyone's problem. It's about poverty. It's about youth. It's about women. And by the way, women have no power, so we have to empower them. That's going to be the solution. HIV is a security issue. We've heard from this country and particularly from this institution. I would argue that HIV is a security issue. It's a job security issue for a lot of people right now. Then we need a multisectoral approach. What has this done? That slush fund of AIDS money, that now close to $15 billion a year, is now available to everybody because it's everybody's problem. It's a development problem. So everyone who's vaguely somehow hooked up with something that's dealing with development now gets to have a crack at the AIDS money. How many people in this room, I suspect there may be a few, actually make a living in association with an organization that gets some AIDS-related funding? And keep your hands up. Okay, now keep your hands up if the organization you work for has either drugs or sex in its title or in its mission statement. Hallelujah. Hallelujah at the back. Because we're now spending, money is available to everyone, and there's really no imperative to spend it on the things that it needs to be spent on. The world of public health is not immune from having its sacred cows. The first, of course, is that we need to have evidence-based decision-making. If ever there was a statement which doesn't rely on evidence, it's the idea that governments respond to evidence. All the evidence is that the more evidence we collect and the more evidence we present, the less difference it makes, particularly in the field of sex and drugs, and large amounts of money. Decisions are made on the basis of political imperative and financial interest more than they are on the basis of data. Another thing that we assume is that people are rational about their health. So we have the health belief model that underpins our behavior change programs, and we think that if people have the information and they have the tools and they have access to those tools, then they will behave rationally and protect themselves from a fatal infection. And I've got news. I mean, there are two things that make one extremely irrational in life, and those are addictions and erections. And those two things are the things that determine HIV risk very directly. Of course, we have a bias in favor of the biomedical, and I'll talk about that a bit more. And the other thing is, if we had more resources, we'd do better at this because we'd be able to build up stronger health systems, et cetera. And there's a big debate, and I'm sure many of you are much better versed in it than I am at the moment, about the balance between HIV-specific funding and wider funding for health systems and the extent to which HIV funding may be undermining health system strengthening by pulling people out of wider health systems. Now, I just want to look at a little bit of data about some of those cows. So HIV is related to poverty. Well, to the extent that most HIV is concentrated in East and Southern Africa, and that's the poorest continent, yes, but within Africa, HIV is very much higher in the richest countries than it is in the poorest countries. That's Botswana and South Africa, the highest per capita GDPs and two of the three highest HIV prevalences, versus Mali and Niger, the lowest on both counts. Within individual countries, HIV is highest in the richest households. So this is, the blue is the poorest fifth of households, the red is the richest fifth of households, and in all of those countries you can see that HIV is more likely to be found. These data are for women, but they look almost identical for men. Education, again, data for women, but they look very similar for men. HIV is associated with more education. So more educated women are more likely to be HIV infected. The whole innocent women and children thing, the idea that somehow it's wicked men who are out there philandering and bringing HIV home to their innocent wives who therefore deserve more help, women are far, far more likely to be infected before marriage in sub-Saharan Africa than men are. Once they are married, men are more likely to bring HIV into the partnership, but premarital sex is much more likely to result in infection for women than for men, partly for reasons of age mixing between older men and younger women. The outside of Africa, we talk all the time about the feminization of the epidemic, and I have yet to see very much evidence of the feminization. Yes, if you look overall, the proportion of new infections that are in women is rising, and it's rising in most countries to on the order of a quarter. That still means that 3 out of 4 new infections are among men. These are data from the United States. And you can see I've disaggregated them by age. This is estimated new infections in 2006, CDC data for the first two blocks. And the rates are per 100,000 of the population. And you can see men are greatly, greatly more likely to be infected than women in all race groups. And gay men, difficult to get a rate because the United States does not actually make any estimates of the number of people in each of its risk populations. China does, Indonesia does, Russia does, Nepal does, Cambodia does, but the United States can't manage to do that. So I've just made an estimate of the proportion of the population, male population that's gay, and assumed that it's the same across all the race groups. And you'll see that it's not only a male disease, it's a gay male disease in this country. We don't see many signs of feminization. The whole women are trafficked. No one would work in sex work unless they were forced to do it, either because they're deliberately trafficked or because they have no other means of supporting themselves, is questionable. These are data from Indonesia, and they show the annual earnings of a sex worker in the dark blue versus the annual earnings of a factory worker in the light blue. And you can see that this is on an annual take-home pay basis. But if you calculate it on an hour's worked basis, you can't make a good graph because you can't see the light blue anymore. It disappears in relation to what you earn as a sex worker on a per-hour worked basis. The whole, well, women are powerless, they can't negotiate condom use, is questionable also. These are, again, data from Indonesia from sex workers. And, in fact, what we're seeing in this graph is that those who don't ask their clients to use condoms don't indeed use condoms. But those who bother to simply ask their clients to use a condom use them at very, very high rates. And this is in one of the countries with the poorest record of condom use in commercial sex. So it's not necessarily that they can't negotiate. It's very often simply that they don't negotiate. But those who do succeed very well. That has implications for our prevention programs. Something else I'd like to say is that we have this assumption that women would protect themselves if they could. You know, that somehow men are pigs and they don't use condoms because they're pigs. But women are all angels. And if they could, if they had somewhere to put a condom, if they could use a condom, they would. Wouldn't that be nice? But the data from a very disappointing microbicides trial shows that even when you've got something that is potentially an effective prevention that you control completely, that the man doesn't have to know about, only 10% of women are using that product consistently. So if we did have female-controlled methods, I don't think that we necessarily should assume that they would get used any more than male-controlled methods get used. So we talk a lot about the socioeconomic determinants of HIV, and we've talked a bit about poverty and gender, and of course all of those things do have an impact. Of course they do, because they shape the sexual relations that we have and the likelihood that we'll be taking drugs and sharing needles. But we have to come back to the fact that HIV is an infectious disease, and to have a new infection you need just three things. What are they? Exactly, two people in a virus. So you need someone, a person with the virus who's infectious. You need a person who doesn't have the virus and who's susceptible. And you need an exchange of body fluids between them. So you need two people, a virus, and an exchange, a way for the virus to get from the infected to the uninfected. And this is really important because an awful lot of our programming doesn't focus on this. We just do things like, oh, we need to increase condom use in, you know, sex between teenagers in Bangladesh. Well, teenagers in Bangladesh are all HIV negative, so it doesn't matter if they use condoms or not from the point of view of HIV infection. There are lots of other reasons that it does matter, but from the point of view of HIV infection, it doesn't really matter. Now, there's another issue that goes back to the infectious and infected just now, and that's timing. And I think that we've greatly neglected this in thinking about our responses. And I think you've probably heard a lot about concurrency recently, so I won't talk too much about it. But just for, you know, viremia 101... assume when you first become infected, obviously the virus stamps out copies of itself very, very rapidly. Your viremia shoots up. Then you start making antibodies and it comes down in a very short space of time. This is a space of time that is maybe 6 weeks long. And then it pops along at relatively low levels until you have other assaults on your immune system. Particularly STI infections are likely to create increased viral load in your genital fluids, where transmission is mostly mediated. And there are other, there's some suggestion that perhaps malaria infection and other infections may have a role there. But basically, you then suppress those and you go on at rather low rates of infection until you start getting symptomatic AIDS. And at this stage, you're probably not churning a whole lot of sex partners because you're not feeling great, you're not looking great, your pulling power is rather reduced, and so you're not actually having all that much sex. So an awful lot of transmission is happening at this early stage. Now, this explains the difference in HIV in Africa. In large part, it explains the difference in HIV in Africa, East and Southern Africa, and the rest of the world. Patterns of sexual networking in East and Southern Africa tend to support two or three or four ongoing sexual partnerships. So it's a pattern that comes from a polygynous model, but people tend to have a number of ongoing partnerships at any one time. In other parts of the world, it's much more common to have very often a much larger number of partners over your lifetime, but to have them in a series. So you're with this guy for, you know, 6 months, and then he takes up golf and turns into a crashing bore, and so you dump him, and then you take up with someone else, and that's all very nice until he gets a pretty secretary who's, you know, and then he dumps you. But in that time span, it's usually more than 6 months, a year, very often much longer than that. And so even if you get infected by that partner, the likelihood that you will pass on that infection to subsequent partners is greatly reduced because you'll be in this low viremic level. So I think this is so important that I'm going to actually show the same thing in another slide and relate it to our programming. So we need to know, first of all, who's positive and who's negative, and then we need to know whether they will have sex or inject drugs together. Now, we do have some programming that is around this area. So we have, obviously, abstinence programming, which we could talk about if anyone wants to, but I haven't even put up here because it gets low success rate. Programs to reduce particularly simultaneous partnerships, and those are also programs to reduce the consumption of commercial sex and the types of sexual churning that are most likely to expose people to HIV, and importantly, methadone. Serosorting in the gay community, particularly people who are seropositive, selectively having unprotected sex with one another, takes the positives out of the positive and negative exchange pool. Methadone for drug injectors is intended to reduce the number of people injecting and therefore particularly take positives out of the pool of injectors. If we fail there, if those programs fail, then and only then do we have to think about the exchange of body fluids. So as I said before, the $25 million that the World Bank gave to Bangladesh $25 million that the Global Fund gave to Bangladesh for HIV prevention among teenagers is actually going to have, it has increased condom use slightly in the very, very small proportion of teenagers who were likely to be having sex anyway, but it hasn't reduced the likelihood of HIV transmission because they weren't seronegative, they weren't serodiscordant partnerships in the first place. The obvious ones here are condom promotion and sterile needles, and I think everyone's very familiar with those programs. If we fail here, there's still things that we can do because HIV is not very infectious and we can make it less infectious and we can make people less susceptible. So there you've got circumcision, which reduces susceptibility in men, lubricant use, which reduces susceptibility in both anal and vaginal sex. Microbicides, I sadly should probably take off the slide for the moment because we're not doing really well with that, but now the likelihood that we can actually combine antiretrovirals directly in microbicides is making that possibly more possible again. The antiretroviral prevention treatments, and I'll talk more about those later, and then the big one, antiretrovirals as a way of reducing the infectiousness of people who are infected with HIV. And I'm going to go back to that because I think that's absolutely critical. STI treatment reduces both infectiousness and susceptibility, and it's the big black hole of our current prevention programs. We don't do nearly enough of it, and we don't do it well enough, and that's partly because in randomized controlled trials we haven't found a way to show that it's effective in general populations. But certainly in the sex trade we need to be doing more of it for its own sake, certainly, and probably because of the very plausible mechanisms that relate it to HIV. Now then the other thing is, will the person survive? And obviously again that's antiretrovirals as well as treatment for opportunistic infections. If the person survives, guess what? You increase the number of people who are HIV positive because the person's not dying, which is very good news. They're also good and healthy and clubbing and out there and having sex and possibly spreading that infection, which is not such good news. So the more of this we do, the more we're helping people to survive, the more of all of this we need to do to reduce the likelihood that they're going to pass on that infection. I just do want to make the point that we do know how to actually make these programs work. In Britain, we started universal needle exchange, universal accessibility of clean needles, when HIV was at 1%, and it never rose above 1%. In New York, we're a bit later. More than one in two injectors were infected by the time New York actually was able, through its state laws, to provide clean needles to injectors. It's been very effective. It's brought down, actually, this, there are new data out just a couple of weeks ago, and this is now at 4%. So that's very dramatic decrease. In Jakarta, when I first arrived, we were measuring HIV in drug injectors, and it was essentially zero. And we did absolutely nothing about it, even though there was a very obvious problem and needle exchange or needle sharing was above 95%. And we now have 55% infection. So it's a choice. You can choose how your epidemic develops by choosing your prevention approaches. It's the same thing in sex, exactly the same pattern. In the Philippines, started very effective programs when HIV was very low, still very low. Cambodia started effective programs very late and came down dramatically. And in Jakarta, once again, you've got to wonder what I was doing in my job there for 4 years. We did nothing, and HIV is now at 10%. And in Africa, too, the same thing. Senegal started early. These are general population, very different types of epidemics, but still, addressing the problem adequately can make a difference. Swaziland, which was at 4% at the same time as we'd already seen HIV coming down the continent, you knew what was going to happen, but when HIV was at 4%, nothing, which was when it was first measured, nothing was done about it. Extraordinarily high levels of simultaneous or multiple partnerships, extraordinarily low levels of condom use, very difficult to talk about age mixing and multiple partnerships when the king of the country has 13 wives, the youngest of whom he married when she was 15. So it's you know, they haven't done anything because they couldn't do anything in their cultural context. It's not only the culture that produces the patterns of sexual networking that lead to these levels of infection, but it's also the culture that inhibits the prevention programs that are needed. Now, the holiest of holy sacred cows, I just want to talk a bit more about. Some of you probably have heard Senator Tom Coburn, who's been talking quite actively about HIV over the last few months, and particularly during the PEPFAR funding debates, and he made this statement: in the field of AIDS, treatment is prevention. Now, who in this room agrees with that statement? So some people do and a lot don't. I agree with it implicitly, because in the field of AIDS, treatment is prevention. Treating HIV prevents AIDS. Question is, does it prevent HIV? Completely different question. And unfortunately, the evidence is that it doesn't necessarily. So, yes, treatment makes people less infectious. So this is where the last graph went to, where people got sick. But and then it brings the viral load down again.
The viral load still continues to spike if you get other STIs, particularly if you have treatment interruptions. So if you don't have really good, strong health systems that are delivering drugs all the time to the people who need them at the places that they need them, you get treatment interruptions and you get the virus bouncing around all over the place. But in principle, it does bring down the viral load and therefore it makes people less infectious. Or does it? Of course, if you don't have any treatment, your viral load goes on rising for a few months. This is probably a period of, you know, a year at most. And then your viral load drops to zero because you die. Now, obviously, that's not a desirable outcome, and it's one that we very much want to avoid, but that's the facts of the matter. So by rolling out treatment, by expanding treatment, we are actually increasing the amount of virus out there. And if we're not doing treatment really well, we're increasing the likelihood that we're getting lots of peaks. Now, of course, this is where everyone says, oh, that bitch, she's such heartless, you know, God, what does she want everyone to die? Absolutely not. Of course we've got to go on expanding treatment. Of course we do. There's no alternative, and there shouldn't be. But we can't do it without doing better at prevention, because we need to prevent people getting exposed to these peaks as well as this one. And that's an important one, because all the evidence that we have at the moment is that things aren't doing really well because this outweighs this. So yes, individuals become less infectious, those who are already infected and who are on treatment. But the number of people with HIV rises in the population and AIDS becomes invisible. So already we've seen it in the gay community. Anyone who became sexually active after 1996, 97, has never seen someone with AIDS, has never seen what HIV can do, because HIV doesn't do that anymore. So the motivation to use condoms, the motivation to reduce your sex partners, the motivation to avoid this hideous disease disappears because the disease isn't so hideous anymore. Sexual risk rises everywhere we've measured it. And because sexual risk rises across the board, including in the uninfected, we're exposing more people to that early peak, and so you're getting more infections. And then there's the treatment takes money away from prevention. We're not doing so well at prevention. Now, these are data from Scotland, but they look identical every single place we've been able to measure this. And that is, so we had this early peak in infection before there was needle exchange. These are identified infections, so there will be something of a treatment bias. It's not a proper incidence measure, but Scotland has a very, very strong health system, and so we're getting most of it. And what happens is that in drug injectors, when treatment is widely available, risk behavior does not rise again. There's no rise in risk behavior in drug injectors, because basically junkies don't want to share needles any more than you want to share your toothbrush with someone you're sleeping with. Yeah, there's lots of body fluids going around the place, but you know what? Ew, that's just icky. And it's the same with needles. So when needles are made easily available to drug injectors, they will use them, and the avoiding HIV thing is not even really part of the equation. Condoms, unfortunately, are not as desirable as clean needles. And so when HIV begins to disappear and treatment becomes available and people aren't so worried about it, HIV starts to rise. This is new infections in gay men. We've seen the same thing in the United States. We've seen the same thing in Canada. We've seen the same thing in Australia. We've seen the same thing in the Netherlands. We've seen the same thing in Belgium. We've seen it every single place we have data. And somehow no one is talking about the likelihood that we're going to see the same thing in South Africa, in Swaziland, in Lesotho, in Botswana, in all the countries where, thanks God, we are getting treatment to more and more people. But it seems extremely likely to me that we're going to see this same thing. And that's really something that we need to think about. So in conclusion, the whole, you know, great, you know, so it's so easy to lay out all the problems. What are the solutions? Well, there are some solutions that are really easy. I mean, we need to fight the technical battles that we can technically win really easily. There is no reason that we should be having disproportionate numbers of HIV infections in prisons anywhere in the world, let alone in countries like this one. Why do we have that? Completely for political reasons, but technically it's the easiest place in the world to do HIV prevention. I mean, talk about a captive population. We need to be making sure that injectors all over the world have easy access to clean needles. This country is doing better and better at it through state funding. Still no federal funds, and it's the federal funds that's setting the agenda for availability of needles in many other countries where the US is the primary funder. That's still a problem. We need to do much better at getting condoms, lubes, and STI screening into the sex trade globally. Rescuing sex workers in raids is not a really effective way of reducing the risk or increasing the life benefits for sex workers around the world. We need to make sure that the health and safety norms in the sex trade are as well regulated as the health and safety norms in any other trade. And we need to start treating HIV like an infectious disease, I think. So other infectious diseases, we do routine screening of people in high-risk groups. We do, or highly likely to have been exposed to the disease. We do contact tracing. We do partner notification. I'm talking about SARS. I'm talking about a whole setup for avian flu should that emerge. I'm talking about syphilis. We routinely do it for other infectious diseases. HIV is currently the only major exception to that. And because we can now provide people with treatment, we need to start breaking down that exceptionalism and treating HIV just like anything else. Everyone's like, oh, the stigma. You can't, you know, force anyone to be tested. We're not talking about forcing people to be tested. We're talking about providing incentives for people to be tested, because if they are tested and they test positive, we can do something useful for them. So I've said, you know, can we bribe our way to victory here? I mean, the truth is that we could make a lot of these things happen by simply making funding conditional on making these things happen and not making funding available for a lot of other pork things around the edges, which institutions are very keen to do, or very keen to take their 30% off the top of, but are actually making no difference to the likelihood that a positive person is going to have an encounter with a negative person, that they're going to exchange body fluids, that one is infectious and one is susceptible. So I think that more and more we need to change the incentives of the AIDS industry so that we fund only those things. Now, those things might be a microcredit screen, microcredit program. If you can show me that a microcredit program is going to alter one of those things, at least one of those things, then that's a legitimate HIV prevention activity. But if you can't show me that it's going to alter one of those things, then you can't show me that it's preventing HIV. So we may need to be doing female empowerment. We may need to have programs for to reduce domestic violence, but you don't necessarily need to do them with HIV money. Get your own toys already. You know, there's a point where, yes, it's a very, very bad thing that men thump women, and we ought to have programs against it. But do you have to fund those programs with HIV money? It comes back to bite you in the field of HIV, because we can't show any reduction in new HIV infections. And so people are, what are you doing with all this money? We've for years said, oh, we just need more money. It's because we don't have enough. But now we have enough, and if we can't show that we're using this effectively, then that money is going to dry up and it's all going to go off to environmental programs. Finally, the emerging challenge is the prevention of a chronic disease. I've said that we know how to prevent AIDS, but we don't know how to prevent HIV necessarily, when HIV does not lead to AIDS. And that's what we're increasingly facing. We're already facing it in rich countries, and we're increasingly going to be facing it in other countries too. And to be honest, I don't think that we really know what to do about that. I mean, I do think we need to keep on with some of the technological magic bullets. The big one to keep your eyes on, if you don't have your eyes on it already, is pre-exposure prophylaxis. That is giving antiretroviral drugs to people who are not infected to reduce the likelihood that they will become infected. You think that giving out condoms to school kids is a political hard sell? I think that we haven't adequately prepared for the political difficulties in trying to sell the idea of giving people antiretrovirals to avoid infection so that they can go on having unprotected sex quite happily. But it's coming. We need to start dealing with it. And I think we need to build up the community demand for prevention. So I don't think that I was rude earlier about the sacred cow of NGOs are best. I don't think that necessarily all programs need to be delivered by community groups, but the demand has to come from communities, because if it doesn't, we're never going to change those incentives. So thank you very much indeed. I'd like to just, on the score of saying, if all of those things, you know, what should we do? I think we should probably pick the battles that we can win easily and give up on the ones that we're not winning so well. And I just want to read a footnote from my book, if I may. The footnotes are the best bit of this book. Don't skip them. I know we have a tendency to. But this is, I got to spend a lot of time cruising around websites that I wouldn't necessarily otherwise spend time on when I was working on this book, including iamworththeweight.com. Check it out. 101 things to do besides having sex. I think they mean instead of having sex, but let's not worry about the grammar. At number 2, go shopping at the mall with your friends. Further down the list are talk on the phone, make a scrapbook, visit a nursing home. Have an orgasm or visit a nursing home. Now, let me see. Thank you.
Okay, I'm the moderator, so I guess I was thinking a lot about language when you were talking and just the language we use and don't use, but I'm going to try to moderate a little bit because, and maybe this is your journalist background, you made a lot of generalizations, and what I was thinking part of the time when you were talking is I've been doing HIV work for 20 years, and my initial entree into doing this work was about the passion of wanting to protect friends who are getting sick. And I think, and I would guess other people who've been doing this for a while have had that same entree into it. But what has kept me into it, in it, besides that, is the complexity of it. And by complexity, I don't just mean, I mean, it's all of the complexities that came out in what you talked about. But for example, you talked about the technical easy fixes, and I guess I would put on the table, I don't know how easy they are, even putting politics aside, even putting the institutions aside, that one would have to grapple with in different settings to make any of those technical easy fixes happen. I think the way that people's lives are and how their lives are structured in any environment is complicated. And two side notes to illustrate that. And one is the number of friends I have who are in the United States, gay men in their 40s who have been negative for, you know, since the emergence of the epidemic, who in the last 3 years have seroconverted, who know all of this. If they don't have the tools to prevent themselves from becoming infected, and I understand in all of their situations the complexity, then I question how easy these fixes are. And I just want to put that out there because there's so much complexity with HIV. And the second is just a report that came out this morning on a totally different topic in the United States about how type 2 diabetes cases have increased so much, and it's linked to obesity and lack of exercise. Well, we could trace out that same causal chain of what happens in people's lives and where you can intervene, and we don't do a good job with that, and that doesn't involve sex and drugs all the time. So I'm just putting those out there as ways to, yes, it's provocative, and I think we all have to think about that and help guide better decision-making processes, but let's also remember this is a very, very complex individual and community realm to try to make any change in, whether you have a political structure that supports it or doesn't support it. So those are my moderating comments, and I'm going to let Janet, who can respond, and then we're going to open it up.
There's so much so much rich material here, and I think mostly the idea is to open up a discussion with this, I'm sure, very eager audience. But I'd like to put a couple things on the table and get a little response, perhaps, and then open it up. One of the things that you focused on, and I should, full disclosure, do a lot of work on women and girls and AIDS in Africa, and I think that when you talk about the women and innocent victims and all that and all the money, actually the money isn't going to them. And if you look at the PEPFAR-focused countries, one of our problems has been targeting beyond PMTCT programs, which we know aren't reaching nearly the scale that they should. The programs actually going to women and girls are very, very limited, and that's one of the things that we've been pushing for. And, you know, I'd love to get some of your reaction to that, but it's certainly linked to building the evidence base. It's certainly linked to how can we make prevention work and why has it been such a disaster? Why are we not reaching, in this case, women and girls with the kinds of services they need to protect themselves and their families? What's gone wrong? And I think part of, and again, I'll be eager for your reaction to this, part of that is that it is in the context of a development situation, that it's very hard, I think, to compare, you know, it was interesting to see your information about income level and education level and all that, because we do see often that the child-headed house, the vulnerabilities of a girl in a child-headed household or an orphan who was brought in by another extended family structure and then is abused by the uncle or the brother. You know, we know all those stories, and they are very real, particularly, as you say, in southern and East Africa. And since that's where most of the infections are, I think it is important to look much more closely at what are the patterns of infection there, who's getting infected, and what are the programs that are actually trying to address the realities that they face. And we have also seen the sort of, you know, sex for talk time, the whole transactional sex piece. I mean, there's a lot of complexities in this, is certainly parallel to what Jen is saying in terms of the lives of women and girls in particularly southern and East Africa. But I think we have failed in part because we've seen it as a strictly as a health intervention and not realized how that is a part of the fabric of their lives, and it will affect whether they're able to access those services down the road, or better still, if they're able to use these tools to help protect themselves in the short term. So that's one thing I'd just like to get your response on. The other piece that you didn't really touch on here, or I don't think in your book either, was the whole realm of sexual and reproductive health more directly. That's obviously a big issue that we're trying to deal with here. But it is a sexually transmitted infection, as you've made very clear in most of the cases, at least, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And yet this whole realm of where women are accessing family planning services or broader reproductive health services, including STI treatment and all that, should they be getting HIV services in that context in a generalized epidemic? And on the other end, if they're in an HIV testing clinic, testing center, and they are obviously sexually active, shouldn't they be getting information about broader reproductive health issues and family planning services and all that? Again, voluntary. We're not saying that this is forced in any way. Obviously, we've had issues in this country that you're well aware of in terms of the sensitivities and the polarization around these issues, but I would think it would be something that you might want to address based on what you've seen not only in Africa and in northern countries, but also in Asia.
Thanks. I'm going to start with the last thing first. I haven't discussed it because it's just such a no-brainer. I mean, there's very little to say. Obviously, yes, those services should be integrated. They should not be. I don't think that HIV services should be exclusively related to existing sexual and reproductive health services, in part because that increases the female bias in terms of service delivery. And I think that we need to be, takes me to your earlier question, I think that we need to actually be working more effectively with men. But yes, obviously you ought to be providing HIV-related services everywhere where you're providing other sexual and reproductive health services, and you ought to be offering other reproductive and health services everywhere you're providing HIV services. Full stop, paragraph. I don't know how to put that more clearly. Yes, absolutely. Yes, of course. I will put it in the toolkit. I mean, it just seems like such a no-brainer. But yes, I will put it there. Well, I'd be interested to hear from people who disagree with that, because there obviously seems to be a debate about it, and I don't see where the debate could come from, so I'd be interested to know that. In terms of women and children, well, first of all, yes, there's not much PEPFAR money getting to prevention programs for women and children, because there's not much PEPFAR money getting to prevention at all. You know, there's a very, very strong skew at the moment to treatment. That's for some good reasons and some not quite so good reasons, even if the outcome is a good one. But quite apart from, I didn't talk very much about the sustainability of antiretroviral treatment unless we do better at prevention. But you're talking about countries that currently have adult prevalences of above 10%. If you take that forward and you look at the lifetime risk of infection, so that you're adding back into the population all the people who would be HIV positive except they've already died, and you're including in your calculation all the people who are in that age group but are not yet HIV positive but will go on to become HIV positive, you're looking at, in several countries, above a third and in some cases more than half of the total population HIV positive if we keep them all alive. So the treatment, and there is no country on earth, including this one, that could sustain treatment for that number of people in any ongoing way. So we need to do better at prevention so that we can keep up with the treatment. Now, what do we need to be doing better in prevention in terms of the vulnerability of women and girls? My tendency is, yes, if we could change the world, if we could change the whole structure of gender relations, that would work. And that's beginning to happen in some countries. We see it, for example, in Thailand. We see it in non-African settings where there's been very rapid economic growth and very rapid urbanization and, very particularly, very rapid increases in enrollment of women at higher levels of education. What effect has that had? It's delaying the age at marriage. It's increasing, obviously, economic opportunities for women. It's increasing the likelihood that women will have independent lives before and, to a lesser extent, after they get married. It's increasing premarital sex dramatically among women. And that is, counterintuitively, reducing exposure to HIV infection because it's taking sex work out of the nexus. Because young guys who can get it for free generally would rather do that than pay. And since young girls are now having premarital sex in numbers that was not previously the case, you're actually keeping people in that uninfected with uninfected bracket. So in a lot of the world, absolute levels of economic progress and particularly progress in women's education is reducing HIV risk. That's a good thing. Can we wait for that to happen? Can we say that's the solution for sub-Saharan Africa, where you've got much, 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 much higher background levels of infection, and therefore you need much lower levels of risk to sustain high levels of new infections? The evidence is not good. You know, we are not doing well in... We've been doing development work in sub-Saharan Africa, both African countries themselves and with help from overseas for... Well, since independence, and the results have as yet not been as dramatic as they have been in other parts of the world. So then, is the solution to plow more money into programs that hope to change the status quo in terms of gender relations? Or might the solution be simply to say, let's not assume that men are a lost cause and it's all about women protecting themselves? Men need to protect themselves too, and we're not doing enough on that score. We're actually doing very little to instill norms of responsible sexual networking and responsible sexual behavior in terms of condom use among men. And men have the power. We don't need to change power structures for that. So stick with the battles you can win. I would have thought, so why have we failed so badly? Because we haven't really tried. I think there have been very, very few programs. They've been use a condom if you play outdoors kind of thing. It's been really limited to that. But programs that work with changing norms among men, I think, would have as great a likelihood of an impact epidemiologically and a greater likelihood of success in the short term. And we are talking about still, you know, a fairly emergency situation where that when you have sex with a new partner, there's a 1 in 3 likelihood that partner is infected with HIV.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. It's time for your questions.
Tell people
And yeah, please say who you are and where you're from. On over here.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the talk. Karen Silbersmith, I'm visiting fellow here at CSIS, coming from the Swiss Ministry of Health. In Switzerland, I'm living in a conservative society as the US, where the basically moral values are not that much different. Nevertheless, we managed to have one of the most progressive drug policy worldwide and one of the most progressive AIDS campaigns worldwide with quite good success. We therefore also experienced recently when we were trying to mainstream the AIDS unit into the infectious disease division, the outcry amongst the AIDS community, oops, that's different, you should leave it where you have the big programs and not take it as an infectious disease. But what I would be interesting is what makes the difference whether a country manages, given their set of value, manages to have a good policy or does not manage. I mean, I made now the difference US-Switzerland, you made it with Senegal, with Eastern Africa. Have you been really studying on what makes the difference that it works in one country and not in another?
Can we take one or two more and then we'll get responses at the same time?
Push the button. Okay. I'm an epidemiologist with AID. Elizabeth, because I spend most of my life in the hyper-epidemics in Eastern and Southern Africa, and I guess I have a request that you consider putting partner limitation in your final list of things programmatically that we ought to be doing, because I firmly think that's the most important thing that we could be doing. Looking at your graph of the peak in incidence worldwide in maybe 1999, I think it's important to look at the point that actually not the numbers of new cases has declined since about 1999 worldwide. Now, a lot of that has to do with the natural history of the epidemic, but a lot of it, in my view, actually is because of behavior change that's largely spontaneous among people who just kind of get it, that having a lot of partners and a number of other things increases their risk. So in terms of the battles you can win, if you look at it in some of the country levels too, you know, the number of countries where HIV market HIV declines have correlated with declines in partners. Again, not necessarily because of programmatic efforts, not just Uganda, but Kenya, Zimbabwe, Zambia, possibly Tanzania, and more actually in Swaziland, where I just was with my colleague this summer, there's some evidence that significant partner reduction has occurred in the last 5 years or so. And it's a little too early to see it in the biomarkers yet in incidence, but it's just given the fact that many people already do appear to be limiting partners, but we haven't even communicated to them the risk of concurrent partnership. I guess I would argue that, you know, a priority for us ought at least to be trying a significant way to try to get the message about the number of partners and helping people in a state-of-the-art, albeit actually in my view conventional behavior change kind of way, that you know, they could and should be limiting the number of partners that they're having. And the ethnography clearly indicates that there is a lot of agency. There are all these social problems, as you say, but there is actually a lot of volition, both for men and women, to change their behavior.
In what makes the difference between a government that does something useful and a government that doesn't is, you know, if I could answer that question easily, I think we wouldn't be in the situation we're in. But I would say that one thing that doesn't necessarily correlate is democracy. Actually, some of the best responses that we've seen have been from rather autocratic governments, or governments that are very, very secure in their democratic majorities. So In the UK, the needle exchange program nationwide was put in by Margaret Thatcher, surprisingly. Now, no one was going to question her credentials as, you know, a good tough-on-crime conservative, and so she was able to do that, but she was able to do that at a time when she had an absolutely unquestionable majority in Parliament. Thailand, the famous 100% condom program, was put in by a military government, essentially after a military coup, so they were able to do that. The best program currently for drug injectors, and particularly drug injectors in prison, one of the best in the developing world, is in Iran. Not necessarily a liberal and certainly not a democratic government. Methadone is extremely, extremely well supported right now and has been scaled up on an extraordinary scale by the Chinese government because they could. So I'm not saying, and Switzerland's a contrary example where you do have a healthy democracy and you've been able to put through programs, but very often, actually, democracies are inimical to good prevention programming. Uganda, I think, probably was able to do what it did because it was coming out of a rather unfortunate civil war. Of course, are you one of? I was amused. UNAIDS, in its infinite wisdom, in its press release that went with the new global report that was issued just before Mexico, had as its first paragraph of its press release, things are going better in parts of the world. For example, we've seen dramatic changes in behavior in Zimbabwe. Like, okay. Dramatic prevention success in Zimbabwe. Now, let's see. What have been the salient features of Zimbabwean society in the last year and a half? 25 million% inflation, a massive exodus of anyone who had the means to be part of that exodus, and particularly people who were needing health services and therefore likely the people who were HIV positive. A complete meltdown of the economy and security, and therefore a meltdown of people's purchasing power and the ability to go out and get drunk and get laid. So, yes, there was a lot of partner reduction in Zimbabwe, but I'm not sure that that model of government and that model of programming is necessarily something we'd like to emulate. I can't answer your question, but it's not always the will of the people that makes this happen. Jim, what am I going to say? I mean, you've made an important point. I don't think there was a question in it. I have a question for you, which is that you say that people, there's been this organic move to lower numbers of partners as a result of people getting it because they see people dying, because they see the effect of AIDS in their communities, because they're dealing with other people's orphans. What happens in a post-AIDS world? What happens in a treatment scenario? Does that effect still hold?
No, I think it's a very important point. You still have, personalized risk perception of that clearly is sort of the major counterbalance to this other, sexual and addiction sort of behavior. I mean, that's clearly, that's a challenge. I still think that, there's enough fear, if you will, of HIV and of AIDS that, we can still work with it.
I think that I'm curious to know how long that will last. I go back to what Jennifer brought up right at the beginning, which is that, she's got friends who are of the survivor generation in the gay community and that are now seroconverting. And I would say, yes, it's partly because of complexity, but it's also because of we do know how to prevent AIDS, but we don't know how to prevent HIV. And, so I don't think we have any technically easy things for preventing the sexual transmission of HIV in a post-AIDS world. I can't. I'm extremely despondent about that, actually, and I don't think we're talking about it nearly enough. Russia. I don't envy you, sir. One of the I don't know what to say, and I'm not familiar enough with the base politics of the situation. Obviously, it's a political problem. But I do think that there is an awful lot of funding for other HIV-related stuff in Russia, which possibly is detracting from the need to do those things. And I think the only thing that you can effectively do in Russia is use bribery. So if we were to make enough money available to do this and only this, it might happen. But I honestly can't think of any other way.
I'm Lori Heise, and I work for something called the Global Campaign for Microbicides, but we work also a lot on PrEP and some of the other things. I was invited to a conference that's going to be happening in about a month about thinking about AIDS in 2 decades from now and what we could be doing now that would be sort of a game-changing proposition, and specifically invited to speak on science and technology. And I had a question for you, and then I also wanted to see what you thought about the thing I've been kind of toying around in my head, is looking at your graph and the dynamics of where most of the infections are occurring. I think you can make an argument from some of it that up to half of them are occurring, in the first 2 months. And so one of the things that I've been toying with is, what if we actually had a way, a simple test that identified those new infections, not waiting for seroconversion, and how that could change both our targeting of interventions, how we, you could be in bed together and you could do a test, and I know in some respects that sounds stupid, but maybe it's not, and so I was wondering, what would you think about something like that and how it might be able to change the complexion of how we would do AIDS prevention? And the second is, I invited someone to do a paper, and I haven't seen what they've come up with, but is there something in terms of a technological or medicinal or prophylaxis that we could be thinking about that would really change how we would approach injection drug users? Because I think a lot of the discussions about looking at biomedical approaches and new things don't focus on the special needs of that population. And so I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about that. And thinking about, if we had one thing other than, is it a better methadone or is it a better... I mean, I don't even know what it would be because it's not a population that I actually deal with. But... it seems like we need to do better in that with that group too. And is there some sort of breakthrough that we should be lobbying for in the long term?
Two more questions, and then I think we're going to have to wrap it up.
Sabine Durier, I work for the International Finance Corporation. You touched briefly on the effect of malaria that leads to a more susceptibility to HIV infection. Could you respond to this or the other panelists, as well as maybe people in the room, so that maybe that would be one of the elements in your toolkit to reduce the number of infections?
My name is Kellen Baker, and I'm a graduate student at George Washington in global health and international development. And I also do work on LGBT health in Russia. So this is in the context of the previous question. I was curious as to what kind of strategies you've seen or what experience you have with what makes those kind of authoritarian governments care about populations that common sense or sort of general wisdom says that they otherwise wouldn't.
Okay. Identifying new infections. I think that we need to pay a lot more attention to that, but I want to actually bring people's attention to where we are now on that score. In this country, in the United States of America, which has a strong enough health system, although we can for those who have access to it, but certainly has a very well-informed population of gay men who, as we know, has been living with the virus a long time and certainly know everything that there is to know about transmission risks and etc. among gay men in this country in the last 2 years, one in between, depending on the place, between one in four and one in five infections are identified at the same time as an AIDS diagnosis. So an HIV diagnosis is made at the same time as an AIDS diagnosis. That is, I think it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace on many levels. I mean, one is testing culture within the gay community is obviously very weak still now. You're talking about people who have been walking around on average for 7 or 8 years with an infection for which treatment is available, and they haven't at any time got into the system and been diagnosed. So that's where we are now, even in the highest risk populations and the most aware populations. So how do we get from there to what you're envisaging? The first thing is actually just to instill routine cultures of routine testing in the same way that people do for their cholesterol and their, you know, whatever you get tested for. I think it would be very, very useful to have a test other than a PCR test, a home test that tested for the virus, not for the antibodies. But yeah, you could use up a lot of Bill Gates's money trying to come up with one of those, I think. You know, it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do for obvious reasons. But it would be very, very useful. IDU, I think there are probably other people in the room who can speak to that better than me. But one of the things that we're seeing is very, very, very poor understanding of dosing levels of methadone. That's a very, very simple thing that we could do better at, is to better understand the dosing levels that would keep people on methadone and off SMAC. Other alternatives, I think, would be helpful. The other one at the moment, you know, that's commonly used is buprenorphine, Subutex, and that has had the unhappy consequence in many countries, including in Indonesia, of now being injected. So Subutex is ground down. The pills are ground down, liquidized, and injected by injectors. So that's not doing so well. Methadone, you can't do that with so effectively. Not very helpful, I'm afraid. But there are probably other people in the room who have a better idea of what we need to be working on with IDU. Malaria, I can't answer your question. The jury's still out, and I'm not familiar enough with the molecular biology and the virology to give you a straight answer. And if there's anyone else in the room who is, I'd really like to hear the answer to that, because I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion of it lately, and no one's taken it to the point of anything that's measurable or practical yet. I mean, I would say, obviously, the knee-jerk reaction is, well, we should be doing malaria prevention and treatment anyway, and we are obviously doing more and more of that, and it's an important investment in its own right. Its likely impact on new HIV cases is unknown, I think, and on viremia is much discussed, but as yet unproven. What makes governments give a damn? Very difficult to determine, but very often an infected child of a prominent government leader. Very often it's a cabinet minister's kid was taking drugs and got infected, and suddenly the government gives a damn. It's you know, it's back to the individualized risk thing, but for individuals who actually can, you know, influence what's happening in global policy. I have yet to find any evidence of people picking up a strategy paper from the CSIS or USAID or anyone else and reading it and thinking, oh, shit, yeah, they're right. Let's change government policy. I don't know how it does happen, but I know how it doesn't happen, and that's mostly how it doesn't happen, I think. I think community advocacy strategies have very important influence in the communities in which they're advocating. Communities advocating outside of their community has been very, very effective in the area of treatment, but has been much less effective in the area of prevention.
Okay. This conversation could probably go on a lot longer. I know that Janet actually has to go.
Can anyone answer the malaria question?
We'll get technical answers, please.
I think I'm not going to get into molecular biology because I'm not a molecular biologist. I think, if we look at the epidemiology of malaria and HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, unfortunately they don't track very well one with the other. Some of the highest epidemics have some of the lowest malaria rates around. So it probably is important, but it probably isn't going to matter in some of the places where HIV is a huge problem. I think treating malaria is very important for anybody with AIDS because we clearly see that there's some bad outcomes there. With regard to testing people, sort of finding people who are in a window period, if you want, I actually spent about an hour on the phone yesterday with the manufacturer of the rapid test that is looking at that. It's not as sensitive as PCR, but it is a whole lot cheaper. And probably early next year, the Centers for Disease Control will evaluate. But the preliminary data make it look very good. I think the real question is, what do you do with that information? And I think the other question is how many of those people are you going to find? And this is one of the things that we've wrestled with Mike Cohen's methodology of pooled PCR, which is if you go into a high-risk population, like an STD clinic, you can probably ferret out people in that. If you're in a an antenatal clinic with a low risk population, the question is, do you capture enough of those people in that point in infection to have a make a difference? So, jury's out. For you, yes. I'm David Stanton with USAID.
Okay, I think some of us can stick around for a little bit, but I'm going to officially close this for those of you who do have to go on. And thank Elizabeth. Everyone, please join me in thanking her for.